Say something.
Yes, number one, what's so bad about rich people? You know, there were guys like Steve Jobs, Wozniak. These guys started companies in their garages, and they became very wealthy. You know what? I never heard of a poor person giving a job. Rich people take their money, put it in the stock market, use their capital. I happen to agree. Let's stop hurting capital. Yeah, maybe they have more money than I do. I don't have that. I'm not producing jobs like Musk is and all of these other guys. I think we can cut the fat out. And what I do have a problem, this is political, and as everybody knows, and you know that I'm blind, I'm a visually impaired person. I hate when they try to scare people. They say, oh, they're going to take away your Social Security. They're not going to take away your Social Security or any benefits because they want to go after people who are ripping off the system, and I happen to agree with that. I don't think they're going to touch people who really, honestly deserve it and who are getting services and not cheating the system, okay? You know what? When I was over in Europe, you know what the big joke was? People would say, oh, I'm collecting Social Security. I'm an American. I came back to Greece for my retirement. And you know what? When I die, I told my family, don't tell the government that I died here. You'll just keep collecting my Social Security. And a lot of people did that. But that's all politics. But at the end of the day, a value-added tax is a tariff. Because if I go to Europe, I'm not a Greek citizen. If I show my passport, I don't pay that tax. When I was in Greece, you know how many people would say, hey, can you do us a favor? Can you go buy us a radio? We'll give you the money. Just go buy the radio because you're not going to pay a tax. And so that's the problem. So when you take a $150 piece of equipment and out charge $50 because there's a sales tax, as far as I'm concerned, that is a tariff. And when they have, if you are not a Greek citizen, you don't have to pay tax. To me, that's a crock of whatever. But, you know, the bottom line is this. Rich people aren't evil, as far as I'm concerned. And you know that as well as I do. If you lower taxes, you increase the amount of revenue because more people will be working, more investments. And by the way, if you have, because they don't need to manufacture, then we'll have some kind of minimum income. There'll be a way for people to make money. There'll always be a way. Anytime you come up with a new technology, you don't put people out of work. You just make different jobs. At one time, you had thousands of people working in an office doing typing. Now it's doing other things, computer work. So anytime you come out with a new technology, then other people find other ways to make money.
November 2, AC2,
yes. Yeah.
Yes, certainly.
You're the topic of the direction, but if you're all right with it, I do have a few questions related to space that are related.
Okay, we got a little distracted, and I kind of thought that this was going to happen with Ed's question. We have a list of other people who signed in earlier who have questions as well. I'd be more than happy to get to you, but we really should go through a few people, and we should kind of kick this loose because we're not going to solve this problem tonight, I assure each and every one of you. Everyone has their own interesting theories and ideas about things. I might point out that the concept of robotics and artificial intelligence can be a ultimate game changer. You know, there's a big difference between going from manual labor to automated labor, service industry. There's all kinds of things. But, you know, I mean, artificial intelligence could be a service industry worker, you know. You don't, you talk to them on the phone. Someday, you know, they'll be all over the darn place. So you can't extrapolate the future from the past. Just because in the past changes in technology allowed us to just shift our resources into other areas doesn't mean that this is an eternal thing. You get something that does each and every thing that all of us do much, much better. Other than the guys who fix that thing, the rest of us are all kind of sit around and stare at a wall. But, again, I don't want to dwell on that. I think we should kind of put a day for this subject. We could bring it up in the future if you want, but we already kind of ran around this for an hour. I really do appreciate that, for the most part, everyone was very well behaved and respectful to each other and didn't degenerate except that one guy with the noise in the background. And, go drink or something. Anyway, I just want to ask Wesley, do you want to go next? I know you're next on the list, but some of these people probably just have one question, and, you know, it's up to you.
No problem at all.
Okay, so we'll jump to John N2ZC. What's your question or your comment for tonight?
Thank you, Roy. Thank you. Thank you for putting an end to this. We're all overloaded with news, so... This is my thoughts, and these things run through my head like I know it does with a lot of people. When we have our discussions about feedback with antennas and coaxial cables, very nice theory of how it comes down the coax on the outer or the inner shell of it. What I noticed, and when we use twin lead, we're able to match antennas that we could never match with coax, specifically even for other bands, etc. My thoughts on this is that the, I'm just going out there, with almost like a quantum knowledge, the antenna using part of the coax, matching it with the antenna and radiating. And those are my thoughts. That's why you're able to get a match when you're using the twin lead, is that you're radiating. It's using the capacitance. It's finding a sweet spot using some of the capacitance in that twin lead and actually using it as part of the antenna to radiate. Now, if you have a better explanation or any thoughts, I'd love to hear it.
AC2GS. Okay, I got a reasonable explanation. It's not the fact that a non-RF choked transmission line radiates power away. It's the attenuation loss inherent to coaxial cables. If you look up for any design, LMR 400, RG58, it will give you a series of decibels per 100 feet for a given frequency. Those are attenuation losses where it's not radiated. You could have it perfectly tuned, or even not tuned, and choked. And so you're not going to get RF radiation per se, but every time you get a reflection back and forth from your mismatched antenna to your, say, antenna tuner, each travel back and forth is going to have a certain number of decibel attenuations. So the beauty of open line is, although it's not an isolated transmission line, in that you have to be very careful of what you put near it, because if you put some conductive material near it, it's going to screw up your transmission. But as far as transmission line, it has a very, very low attenuation loss. So you can bounce back and forth a dozen times on open line and have very little decibel loss. That's the reason why you can get away with a relatively mismatched antenna. It's the same way that people put their antenna tuners right at the antenna feed. So if you do that, you don't have to worry that you need open line with a low attenuant loss, because it's not reflecting back and forth. It's just going from directly from the antenna feed to the antenna tuner. How's that?
Bravo. You're 100% right.
Thank you, Howie.
Yeah, all right. It sounds good. I'm glad I asked that question. I always like to get something if I'm thinking I'm along the wrong tracks there. So if I understood you correctly, with the coaxial, it's not that it's matching worse. It's that it's losing attenuation on these bands, that the twin lead isn't losing that power and it's able to radiate it. The only question that I still have is that how come you can't match it? I mean, I can understand if it's a lesser signal, there's attenuation, but you can't, and I take 100 feet of coax on a dipole, and there's no way a 40-meter dipole, you're going to get it to match up to transmit on 20, to just get tremendous feedback, but you could possibly get away with it with twin leads. So I'm still left with it that does seem to match better.
It's not that it matches. Again, every time your signal bounces one direction, there's a certain amount of resistive attenuation loss that's turned into heat. Say it has an attenuation loss of 3 dBs for 100 feet. So that signal goes up there at 100 watts, and 50% of it is attenuated and turned into heat. Now, if you're tuned, that's it. It's 50 watts you've lost, and you have 50 watts to play with in your antenna. If you're mismatched, you'll get a reflection. So a portion of your transmission, a portion of the 50 watts that makes it to the antenna feed, will then reflect back down, and it will be attenuated again. And the antenna tuner box will kind of reflect it back, and then you'll get a little bit more attenuation. So it's the fact that the internal design of open wire has very, very, very small attenuation losses to the reflection of your signal going back and forth. Whereas a coax cable, depending upon how thick it is, if you get something really tiny like LMR 174, it would be horrendous at UHF frequencies because of the attenuation loss. So it has to do with the attenuation loss. In both cases, if you have a matched antenna, it's always better. Except that, of course, that even with open line, you won't have some more significant loss going one direction. So you'll still have more energy making it to the antenna itself to radiate. So it's just the nature that coaxes are more lossy, but you trade that in for the isolation. If you grab coax cables, bundle them together, and not give a damn. You try to do that with open line, and you're screwed.
I understand everything you're saying, but I just can't jive it with. Let's just say theoretically, you got an antenna, and you have a 3-to-1 match with coax, and you have a 3-to-1 match with open line, and I agree with your whole theory about the coax being more lossy. And under those conditions, then you should be transmitting. And again, we're just throwing numbers out there. So if you're transmitting 100 watts, and with the twin lead, maybe you're going to get 30 watts up there. And with the coax, you get 1 watt up there. If that was the result, I'm fine with it. But what I find is you cannot get the same match. So we're just talking impedance, LRC, a match, a transfer of power, the same on a coax as what you can with the twin lead. And there, you know, your losses, the argument there, yeah. And you may be right in all this. It may be something that I just got to come to terms with. I don't see. But I understand what you're saying, but you cannot get a match. Many times, forget about the loss. It's just a match. You'll get incredible feedback, which really, if the losses then should be less, then the feedback should be less. You lose it. It's just that you can't match the coax as well as you can match the twin lead.
WB2HWW.
Yes, Howie.
When? Dick is here tonight. Okay, let me see if I can help this guy understand it. Okay, take a 3-1. That means the signal goes back and forth 6 times, whatever it is. The signal leaves your transmitter, goes to the antenna, because there's a difference of impedance between your transmission line and the load, which is your antenna. Some of that power is going to transmitter. Because your transmitter is a constant current source, that signal is going to go back to the antenna. It's going to keep doing that. And finally, it's going to get launched. That energy finally has to get radiated. Now, every time it goes back and forth, it loses some power because of the attenuation. When you look at twin lead, it's basically a balanced structure. And as long as you don't affect it, it has losses like 0.1 dB per so many feet. So if you go back 5 or 6 times, you may be losing a half a dB. That's very little. So if you got 100 watts and it goes back 6 times over a piece of coax, you may only have 20 watts getting radiated. But if you use twin lead, you'll get almost 90 watts. So you're going to have very little loss with transmission line. Yes, if you don't match the antenna, then you're going to have standing wave ratios, and those are going to keep bouncing back and forth till it finally gets radiated. At some point, that signal is going to leave the antenna. Does that make any sense?
I think it's a classic example of... I understand perfectly, understood from the beginning, the whole concept that you explained. I understand it perfectly, and I knew it. But I don't think that either you or Roy are understanding my, I'm not going to question it as a statement, but as a hypothesis here, or as an observation, okay, is that, again, forget about the loss. I understand that fully. And as a matter of fact, it supports my argument. That if you took a piece of coax and a piece of twin lead, and they both had 3-1 match, I mean, because you have less of a loss, you're going to have more feedback coming back into the rig. Okay? You're going to have more than the coax. But that doesn't happen. You could get a linear amplifier, and you'll blow it out trying to get it to match with a piece of coax. It can't do it. It's just too much feedback coming in. Now, again, taking your argument, which I don't think has anything to do with this, with it going back and forth on the coax, it should be actually helping it. It's trying to match a lower power. But you take that same antenna and you use some random piece of twin lead. Let's just say you cut them both to 200 feet or 100 feet. The twin lead can be matched much easier and much better. And we see this. We see this with the G5RVs and everything. They will not work without the twin lead. The twin lead acts as a matching device. Now, I'm not talking about when you take a quarter stub or anything like that. I'm talking about just the actual twin lead. It seems to match. It seems to balance. And we've always heard, and I think this is where it comes from, about twin lead radiating in the shack. Well, you know, I think twin lead, again, that was my original statement or observation here, that I believe that the twin lead actually radiates at some length along with the antenna, enabling it to match.
KF2ZZ.
Yes, Brian?
Oh, good evening, Roy. I know I'm late. I was trying to connect via your Echo Link on my iPhone. It doesn't seem to work.
It's not my Echo Link. I have an Echo Link for another club, but the club W2VL, the Echo Link is working. I'm connected to the Echo Link there. There might be something a little bit strange about your setup.
Sorry to interrupt the conversation. I'll stand by.
WDHHWW. Right. Can I make a couple more comments about the twin lead and the amplifier?
Sure.
The reason why your amplifier is going to blow up is you don't have enough tuning. Yeah, you can, if you have enough inductance and a big enough pi network, yeah, you could tune an amplifier into no load. You have to match the impedance of the plate to the output, okay? That's what a pi network does. Number two, twin lead doesn't radiate. The only time it radiates, and why it may radiate in the shack, because things are nearby. When you have twin lead, you have to keep it away from everything. Twin lead is a balanced structure. And the reason why you're able to match twin lead easier to a G5RB, a G5RB wants to see a balanced transmission line, common mode balanced line, okay? So basically one side is hot, one side is cold, and it keeps going back and forth as the sine wave. A piece of coax is an unbalanced structure. You have a hot and you have a shield. Okay, it's an unbalanced transmission line. That is what you have. That's why you use balance on a piece of coax, because you don't want it to radiate back. But on a piece of twin lead, you don't care if the signal goes back and forth. So it can keep going back and forth. If I have on a piece of coax, that is, if I have a 50-ohm load with a 50-ohm piece of transmission line, my signal travels all the way down the coax, hits that 50-ohm load, and goes into the resistor or into the antenna, and then gets dissipated. Doesn't come back. But for example, if I am going into a 100-ohm load, then I'm going to have a 2-to-1. That signal's going to go down the transmission line, hit that load, and half that power is going to come back towards the transmitter. Then the transmitter is going to try to send it back. It's going to keep going back and forth, till it finally get dissipated. Okay? It has to go somewhere. Every time it goes down that transmission line, you lose energy. If it's coax, it's not feedback. Don't think about it as feedback. It's called standing wave ratios. Roy, can you help me? Because I don't know if I said it clearly enough.
Well, I mean, at one point, don't you mean a balanced differential current?
Yes, it's balanced differential current. It's a balanced structure. A shear, yes, it's a balanced structure. But you have low loss, so the signal keeps going back and forth, back and forth. The bottom line is this. If I have I don't care what the transmission line is. When you go from one structure, from transmission line, to something else at the end of that transmission line, if the impedances aren't the same, then I'm going to have reflected power. If I have a 1-to-1 match where the end of that coax goes into a 50-ohm load, then all the power goes into the load. But if that load is different, then some of the power is going to go back down the transmission line, go to the transmitter, and then get reflected back down the line again. And at some point, it's going to get dissipated.
Yeah, it's not loss, it's just reflecting back and forth. But the resistive attenuation loss of the transmission line determines how much finally gets to the antenna feed. And there's nothing particularly magic about open line. Open line, as you said, doesn't really radiate. If it radiated, how could it be relatively low loss? So it doesn't radiate. It is not isolated, as I mentioned earlier. And so as opposed to coax cable, where it doesn't matter where you put the coax cable, it's very important the local environment of open line, because it can couple and do terrible things. But there's really nothing magic about open line that balances, per se, a transmission line to kind of give it better resonance. It depends upon the design of the open wire. The dimensions determine the impedance. Hopefully you either want an impedance that matches the antenna feed point, or you need a balance to adjust the feed point to open line impedances, and if you get it right at residence, then you don't have to deal with multiple reflections. But even if you do get some degree of reflections with open line, you get less attenuation loss, so it's much more forgiving. So that's why when people put up doublets of non-resonant dipoles, they'll use open line and they'll use a antenna tuner at the shat end and not have significant enough losses to worry about.
VHT.
Yes, Jim?
I'm operating above my pay grade here, but if you'll permit, I'll give a translation with a completely inadequate mechanical analogy, which you hate, but I think it helps some of us kind of catch up. And the questioner is way more advanced than me, but anyway, I liken a coax cable to a pipe. It's a rigid structure, there's a rigid volume inside. I liken the twin lead to a Roman aqueduct. It's an open trough. And any back pressure that comes along the trough just spills out the sides, causes no trouble to anybody other than the people that get wet. Gross oversimplification, but I think it is worth imagining as you talk about the subject.
Okay, I mean, you're free to use whatever analogy that you want. Most analogies are somewhat flawed. I think this one's flawed, too, because that would suggest that open line is leaky, which it isn't. Coax is much leakier. It'll reflect back going from differential mode, which doesn't radiate, to common mode, which does radiate. So that analogy kind of explains the wrong thing for the wrong transmission line, personally. But, you know, you use what you works for you.
Comment?
Certainly.
HK2GJE. A bad antenna is always a bad antenna. Yes, there's more loss in coax, so there's less loss in what they call twin lead or open wire line. I think everyone agrees to that. Don't say it can't be matched. Anything can be matched with a good antenna tuner. I worked at some transmitter sites in Europe. Why they gave us what they gave us, I don't know. The transmitter was capable of way above 600 watts. The antenna tuners that we had were fantastic. They all had vacuum variable condensers and many of them, and they all had plated coils. They were enormous. They were well built, and God knows what the government paid for them. But anything can be matched over.
I agree with you entirely. My Palstar, I think, could match a doorknob.
Hello. Work all states.
The only comment I can make here is this. Think of Cat 5 cable. Why do they use Cat 5? They don't use shielded cable. They use Cat 5. It's cheap, and believe it or not, it's a very well shielded. It's not a it's twisted pair. You can take a twisted pair wire and make it very low loss and not radiate at all. Go ahead, Rod.
Yeah, it's basically open line. You know, I think the telephone company discovered that ages and ages and ages ago, and twisted pair, I think was how they arranged their wiring. And, you know, now we have category 7, 8, and some of them are shielded as well. But you know, I mean, these are special cases where gigabits are being transmitted over relatively long lengths of wire that require the shielding in addition to the twisted pair, and they do tricks with the twisted pair. All the twisted pairs are not identical. They're slightly different.
Why not twisted pair for transmission lines?
I would assume it would kind of give you weird impedances that you had to deal with. Also, you wouldn't want to put a lot of power because, you know, the dielectric insulation between the two wires is fine for Ethernet or telephone. But, you know, if you're going to throw a couple of 100,000 watts out there, that might be a little too much for that.
Roy, all I can say is that Dick upstairs is probably looking down and laughing because, you know, transmission line theory is a pretty complicated thing. We both had the structure at different times. And you get down to the theory of unilarity and using functions and you look at how a transmission line behaves, it's all magic. It's black magic, but when you do all the math, it does work out. WDHWW.
Comment?
What? Yes, please comment.
That's me at K2GJ before I say 73. I remember Dick saying years ago that most people do not see wire. Only hams see wire. I saw a beautiful antenna out here where I live. It was a folded dipole made with open wire line. It looked like it was cut for about 40 meters, and it was fed open wire line. Really beautiful done. I don't know whose it was or what it was for. It was at a factory site. They may have been testing something or what. I don't know. It was really beautiful, and ham see wire, and it was unusual to see something made like this out of open wire line. Have a good evening, everybody. 73.
You too, Ed. I don't know if non-hams don't see wire. I have found personally, it's a matter of elevation. I had an antenna set up that I was going to lift up to the roof, and when it was on the ground, there were a lot of people afraid of it. And as soon as I raised it 20 feet, no one looks up, no one saw it, no one cared. So I think it's more that most people just don't look up. Okay, I think Ed just really turned off the radio at the end of that. Brian, what do you want to say?
A couple of things. If you could put me in the queue, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, I don't know if we're going to get to everyone tonight because it's already 9:34, and there's three people ahead of you, Brian, but I'll put you down.
Could I change that for a quick comment?
Okay.
Last week, we were speaking about Japanese screwdrivers, correct? And I forgot who the person is that had a stripped screwdriver. Do you know who that would be, and is that person online right now with us?
Yeah, that's Rich, W2BZ. He's on the list tonight as well. And that's a JIS screwdriver. A Japanese industrial screwdriver that we were talking about last week.
Correct. And I said that any metric screwdriver would work. And to an extent, that's true for the diameter of the screw head and the shaft. But when it comes to the actual screw head design, in terms of what you need to put into the screw, those heads are either they have ISO heads, which is for International Standards Organization, and then they have JIS in Germany as well. So I said to myself, why was I not able to go ahead and strip a screw in all these years? And I opened my toolbox, and lo and behold, I looked through my tools, and 90% of them were all JIS tools.
Okay. I mean, theoretically, there are a lot of people who are totally unaware of GIS, and they tend to use what they have, and they tend to have Phillips, and they tend to get away with it. It's a similar shape. It's not an identical shape. So it's a lot easier to strip a GIS using a Phillips. The original developer of Phillips screwdrivers was Canadian. Okay, that explains why you had such good luck.
And I have about 10 different screwdrivers, different kinds, that are all made by a company called Vessel. And Vessel, if I remember, years ago, because I had these screwdrivers for years, is a Japanese company. And that would explain it, you know, to me. And there's also screws that have a dot in it, that I've seen, Phillips head screws that have a dot, and they all have different standards. So just putting in a regular Phillips head with a Japanese screw is not the best way to approach the problem. And I take that back, and I stand corrected.
KD2FIU portable.
Okay, George, we'll get to you in a second. The screws with the little divot in the middle are security screws. So theoretically, the manufacturer doesn't want everyone to be able to unscrew it, so you need to have a driver that has that little pivot point. Otherwise, you can't grip the screw head and such. George, you want to say something?
My advice to Rich, W2BZ, was when you feel that the Phillips head is not going to break it initially, go right to a slotted of the appropriate size. So you're going to need both, all of the Phillips sizes and all of the slotted sizes. And you don't go at it like you're pulling it out. You go at it with a slight crack. If you remember last week, I was addressing two of his problems very specifically, and one was that you don't go at all crazy with Phillips screwdrivers if you can't break it with the appropriate Phillips screwdriver. Go for the slotted, which will sit in very tight, give it a slight crack. KD2FIU.
Okay, George, yeah, I remember last week. I remember you mentioning that. You mentioned that twice last week. But the thing I keep on trying to add into the equation is he shouldn't be, if at all possible, he shouldn't be fiddling with a Phillips screwdriver, because this is an ICOM device and it no doubt has a GIS screw head. So if he's going to try a screw head that's designed to fit the screw, then he should use a GIS screw head, not a Phillips one.
PhD.
And one more thing. If you have a regular ISO Phillips head screw, you could use the GIS screwdriver in that ISO screw head.
Roy, KD2FIU clear.
Okay, Jim, you wanted to say something?
Do I have it?
Yep.
I was very intrigued by this topic last week, very intrigued, and a little research yielded something that really struck me. I did not know that the Phillips head design, in its initial design, was designed to cam out in the aeronautic fasteners before it broke the screw. So it was designed for the driver to cam out of the head before the screw broke in assembly. So it's a head design that's designed to fail. That explains a lot of things I've experienced in my life with mechanical things. The GIS standard is not designed to fail. It's a totally different design, and it's very interesting. And we can talk all week on this, all different meanings about it, but at its onset, that was the difference. I found that very interesting. It will help me in a lot of things in the future. Back to that.
Comment.
Okay, very good, Jim. Yes, Brian?
Yes, I don't know if we doubled or something when I was speaking, but that's okay. I was mentioning that if you have an ISO screw head, typical Phillips Hill screw, and you don't know what it looks like, where it came from, you could always use the GIS screwdriver in order to go ahead and take it out with a high degree of safety, but not the other way around.
Okay. I think it's not that terribly costly to have some GIS screw bits available and just use them. And so improve your chances as much as humanly possible, especially, you know, if you got some gear from Japan, an ICOM, a Yaesu, whatever, chances are it's a GIS screw. So, and, you know, not everyone can recognize the differences. And so, you know, cost me $9 for a set of, set of six GIS screw bits.
W2PC.
Yes, Rich?
I totally agree with George's solution, because over my lifetime, I have stripped screws, and I have gotten them to turn with a slotted screwdriver, putting a pretty good amount of pressure down and then just turning it a little bit. I have gotten many stripped Phillips heads to turn. This one, the metal is so soft on these screws, I think they do that just to save money, I guess. But it's so soft, I don't even know if a slotted solution would work. Anyway, could we get on to my question now, Roy?
I just have
Okay, Brian.
Very quickly, that technique using a slotted screwdriver is for already stripped screws. Do not attempt on new screws.
Well, that's a given. That was the whole premise. The premise was he stripped the screw out of the get the screw out. So that was kind of baked into the thing. I don't know. Everyone's silent. Rich, the problem is that the second person to check in was Wesley, and I get the distinct feeling Wesley wants to do his thing. So is it okay if he does his thing, and if we have some extra time, we'll get to you tonight? If not, we'll put you up first next week. How's that?
Next week will be fine, Roy. Even though it does dovetail very well into the discussion about matching, because it's about tuners. So I would hate to lose everybody's knowledge on what was just discussed, you know, to next week.
Well, I mean, hopefully our memories aren't that bad, and most of the people who came tonight will come next week. You know, I mean, matching is a very common discussion for technical matters as well. So I think most people will keep that knowledge intact for a week.
All right, then I'll ask it next week.
Okay, very good. Wesley, what do you got for us?
Short and direction. Fourth object. The first one on the list was a bucket of salt water imitating salt water amplifier. I mean, it's not precision wording, it's just the wording that was used on the video, but it looks like it is very much present in ham radio work. So, in other words, is somebody thought about the solution of having a 55-gallon salt water bucket imitating the condition of those ham radio operators having the ocean next to them. and I would love to hear your opinion, Dr. Rog. Back to you.
Okay, you might want to kick up the amplitude. You sound like you're whispering to us. Yeah, I mean, you sent me this weird video where this guy talked about, and we all know cases. I know guys for the 10-meter net who kind of get into the car and then park it next to the beach, and they get nice range for a bunch of different reasons. You have a ground plane. You have a clear horizon. There aren't apartment houses in the ocean. So there's a lot of reasons why operating near bodies of salt water are very effective for radio transmissions. You can't mimic it by just getting a 10-gallon tub and putting salt water near it, because if you had a 10-billion-gallon tub, maybe, and you poured... I don't know. Am I connected again? Yeah, okay. It dropped out of All-Star, unfortunately. Anyway, if you could simply flood the entire area with salt water, yes, it would be somewhat beneficial. But a tub with a small amount of salt water isn't going to do anything.
Okay. Interesting. If I was to play devil's advocate, if you have antenna on your car, antenna on your car, a dipole in your car, right? The body of the car is serving as a counterpoint. So if you happen to have enough water in the bucket to serve as a counterpoint, strongly enough, comparing to the car body, you would probably have the same effect, right or wrong.
If it had the same mass, I guess so.
Okay. So the opinion from the video was, tell me if I put the volume up a little bit, tell me if it's good now.
It's adequate, but it could be a little bit louder.
Okay. So I'm not trying to have a situation where my signal is overwhelmingly distorted, but I can try a little bit. How about, now it's going to be distorted. How about now? Hold on.
It's a little bit.
How about now?
That's fine.
Okay. So, there was a map on that video estimated effective ground conductivity in the United States. Did you see that map? And do you have a comment on it?
Yeah. It shows salt water areas. And obviously, the difference between salt water and the river water is the resistance. There's a higher resistance of distilled water than there is slightly mineral dissolved, and the resistance of salt water from the ocean is very, very low. You know, micro-ohms. Micro-mohs? Micro-whatevers. It's very conductive.
All right, interesting. So, it's not going to do so much good. It's going to give you some good. I mean, if you need to have counterpoise, the bucket of salt water would be better than regular counterpoise. Back to you, Dr. Ray.
I don't think there's any inherent benefits to a counterpoise being a conductive material that's dissolved ions and, you know, salt water. Again, it has more to do with the volume, whether it's a decent counterpoise or not. That's not the mechanism that people use to get out near near oceanfront areas. Again, it's primarily you're getting a ground plane, not just a counterpoise, and also getting a clear horizon because you can't build too many co-ops in the middle of the ocean.
Yes, but at the same time, if you were to pour salt water into the ground where your counterpoise are, conductivity would be better, back to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you're doing antenna theory and you're doing the easy NEC to analyze on a theoretical basis, one of the important parameters you have to really include for accuracy is the type of ground phenomena. Do you have rocky ground? Do you have wet, loamy ground? Do you have clay? You're near the ocean, so it's kind of damp. So the underlying ground's moisture and salt content can make a significant difference in antenna capability.
Okay. The second one, Dr. Roy wasn't eager so much to talk about it, but I kind of asked for it. So the original material sent to him was Khan Machin Think from Science Perspective, and this is the subject of AI introduced by a mathematician who is a woman. That it was the video, the author of the video, and she was referring to the original Turing test paper that by her work was unbelievably visionary. I would love to hear Dr. Roy comment on it. The video was about AI, not about the paper. And she included in it, because the paper spoke about it, the test that had three people, man and the woman and the interrogator, and there was about the sex. With the interrogator being in the second room, not being able to recognize who is talking, who is relating the information, let's say on digital form, what is the sex of that person? But at the same time, I would love to hear some comments from Dr. Roy about it. Dr. Roy.
Okay, I mean, I kind of consider it old news since it's based on a paper that was written 5 years before I was born. I was born a while ago. So, it's the basis for what everyone calls the Turing test, although in its original form it was much more complicated because it was a paper. It wasn't something you could say in three sentences. So in his paper he discussed variation, the origin of the Turing test, which is you have a guy in one room who's able to pass messages back and forth. And the question initially is, you may have a man in the other room, you may have a woman in the other room. If there's a man in the other room, he's been told to make believe he's a woman. So you ask the person questions, you get back answers, and based upon their answers, whether or not you could tell if it was really a woman or was a man making believe he was a woman. Part two is now you take the woman out of it, I guess, entirely, and you replace it with artificial intelligence. And now can you tell the difference? And it's rather vague whether it's the difference between a woman talking to you or an artificial intelligence or just a human being versus an artificial intelligence. And that's ultimately what everyone today knows is the Turing test. And there have been people writing programs to try and trick to pass the Turing test. In the past, unfortunately, they were rather simple. Keyword matching response, because memory and computer power was very small. So back in the good old days, you couldn't quite tell if it was a robot, whether it was a psychotic human or a robot with AI. Because although they had answers, they didn't quite make sense of being a sane human being. So that was the best Turing test could give you, was you could tell whether it was a crazy person or an artificial intelligence. Times have changed, and unfortunately, we have been moving the goalposts, as the saying goes, to what is what should be considered consciousness. Just because you can sound like you're conscious doesn't mean that you are. Presently, the present AIs are not conscious. They don't think. They are simply matching sentence patterns based on scanning billions of conversations. So they're not alive. They don't have a conscience. They don't have morals. They don't have ethics. They don't have anything. They don't think. They can't kind of come up with something clever unless it's related to previous things that they can string together.
Okay. So I'm going to make a statement that consciousness is the future of the animal's brain from group of mammals. And it's a machine. It's a biological machine, but it's a machine. The question is the statement right? And the second question is the machine made by a human able at some point to reach the level where the consciousness would be assigned to it? Back to you.
Yeah, what would you like to comment? You're not getting into the repeater. What, Wesley?
No, I made a comment, but I'm not sure because I'm on echo. My transmission hurt.
Yeah, unfortunately, someone wants to make a comment, but he's right at the edge of the repeater, and all it's 99% noise. Sorry. Anyway, at this point, there is no man-made device that is conscious. Is it possible to build one? Probably. Do I know approximately how long it'll take? Is it a matter of days or years or centuries? I don't have a clue. I don't know if generative AI is the fundamental method that we're going to use to have a fully functioning artificial intelligence. We might hit a wall. We might not hit a wall. We won't until we break through the wall. So, yeah, it's all guesswork at this point.
So from biological point of view or medical point of view, what is the consciousness? No, it's not really the question, what is the consciousness, but what is so special in consciousness achieved by animals like us?
It's an emergent characteristic based on increasing complexity. Most animals just do not have the raw computational power that human beings evolved to have. It's very costly, by the way. Our brain uses way more energy than most rest of our body. But it has improved our chances of survival so much that it offsets the costs. And so, you know, it might not be a good trait in the long run. We may end up killing ourselves. You know, our intelligence will give us the power to destroy ourselves maybe someday. So you never know. But it's an emergent trait due to increasing neurophysiological complexity.
Okay, so what is the difference between, if we take the group of mammals that a human animal belongs to, what is the difference between consciousness of a human animal and other animals from group of mammals?
again, we happen to have evolved a very expensive, high power requiring brain. Most animals don't. They just get by with what they have, and they're not really evolving to be particularly smarter because there's no particularly evolutionary thing that would make